From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. If you go to NASA's website, you can find lots of pictures and videos showing off its Constellation program, the rockets and spaceships being developed to return astronauts to the moon. Well, if the Obama administration gets its way, all of that will soon be gone. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, the proposed budget kills the Constellation program and relies on private companies to rocket astronauts into orbit.
7 years ago today, Space Shuttle Columbia broke up on its return to Earth. Everyone on board died. In the wake of that disaster, then-President George W. Bush laid out a new vision for NASA. It called for retiring the space shuttle by 2010 and returning astronauts to the moon by 2020. Well, the space shuttle program will end this year, after just 5 more flights, but officials now say the moon plan is off track and misguided.
The truth is, we were not on a sustainable path to get back to the moon's surface.
Charles Bolden is a former astronaut and the head of NASA.
And as we focused much of our effort and funding on getting to the moon, we were neglecting investments in the key technologies that would be required to go beyond.
Bolden spoke during a teleconference on the proposed new budget for NASA. The budget kills NASA's Constellation program, saying it's too costly, behind schedule, and lacks innovation. Instead, the budget extends the life of the International Space Station and gives NASA funding to buy astronauts high-tech taxi rides to the station on spaceships built and operated by private companies. Bolden vowed that NASA would still provide oversight to ensure the astronauts' safety.
I flew on the space shuttle 4 times. I lost friends in 2 space shuttle tragedies. So I give you my word, these vehicles will be safe.
He said NASA would be freed up to develop new technologies, like ways to refuel in orbit. He says these are needed to someday go not just to the moon, but beyond. Bolden also noted that NASA is getting a substantial budget boost, an additional $6 billion over the next 5 years. The proposed changes are in line with what a blue-ribbon panel of outside experts recommended last fall. Former astronaut Sally Ride served on that panel. She thinks this shift in NASA's direction would be a good thing.
It ensures that as we explore the solar system, we'll be doing it with new technologies and we'll be doing it arm-in-arm with our commercial and our international partners.
But it would be a big deal to cancel a huge multi-billion dollar program like Constellation and turn to spaceships designed and run by private companies. John Logsdon is with the George Washington University's Space Policy Institute.
It is a different approach to doing human spaceflight than NASA has followed really since its earliest days.
He says this kind of change would put NASA under a great deal of stress in the coming months and years.
It's not going to be fun for anybody.
Some lawmakers have already raised concerns. Republican Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama said the proposed budget, quote, begins the death march for the future of U.S. human spaceflight. Democratic Senator Bill Nelson is a former astronaut who represents Florida. He says it's a gamble that private companies will be able to develop new spaceships quickly.
If they don't make it, or if they're delayed, then we're up the proverbial creek without a paddle.
He noted that even though the president can propose changes, any major decisions will have to be made jointly with Congress. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
President Obama's health overhaul plan for this country is stalled in Congress, but health care was a major priority in the budget the president sent to lawmakers yesterday. While other kinds of programs are scheduled for cuts or having their funding frozen, health care did well by comparison. Still, as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, more health funding challenges lie ahead.
Speaking to reporters, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius defended the fact that the programs under her purview did, well, pretty well.
We target relief directly to working Americans who need the most and make long overdue investments to strengthen our health care and public health systems, keeping all of us healthy and more secure.
The department's 2 biggest programs, Medicare and Medicaid, were never going to be part of the administration's proposed 3-year spending freeze. But it turns out that a lot of programs that won exceptions to the freeze are also part of HHS. The National Institutes of Health, for example, would get a $1 billion increase next year. Community health centers, which are also popular with Democrats and Republicans, would get a $290 million boost. Those increases didn't go unnoticed by people like New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg, the senior Republican on the Budget Committee. Here's how he put it on Fox News.
I think it was Einstein who said that insanity is doing the wrong thing over and over and expecting change. Well, this is fiscal insanity to continue to grow the government the way we're growing it, to continue to spend the way we're spending, continue to raise the debt the way we're raising it. We're going to pass on to our kids a country that basically is insolvent.
Groups that lobby for money for public health programs, though, feel like they dodged a bullet.
It means that these programs, these public health agencies, are an important part of the administration's vision looking forward.
Julio Abreu is a lobbyist with the health group Mental Health America and the president of the Coalition for Health Funding, which represents dozens of organizations. He says many of the groups that are part of his coalition are also working for the health overhaul, but while they wait, he says the programs they support in the budget can fill important holes.
These programs tend to be of a prevention nature. They tend to help develop workforce. They are early intervention with programs like Head Start, programs like suicide prevention.
Indeed, Secretary Sebelius said some of the proposed budget increases are already aimed at laying the groundwork for a health care overhaul, whenever that happens. That includes things like digitizing medical records and studying which kinds of medical procedures work better than others.
There is a new platform for health care built in this country.
But she also pointed out that there are a lot of things that just boosting budget lines can't do.
It doesn't change dramatically the cost trajectory or certainly fill the coverage gap or provide security to lots of Americans who have coverage right now but are really at the mercy of health insurers who make rules day in and day out that lock people out of the market, kick people out of the market, limit coverage.
Meanwhile, even before Congress gets back to health overhaul or digs into the budget, it has an even more immediate health issue to address. If it doesn't act by the end of February, doctors face a 21% cut in their Medicare payments. That would anger both doctors and patients, noted Roger Wetzel of AARP in a recent webcast.
If the scheduled cut goes into effect, we can certainly expect to see more physicians no longer accepting Medicare patients.
The budget assumes that Congress will fix the Medicare doctor pay problem, but that doesn't mean it will be easy. Nothing to do with health ever is. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
While the administration is proposing a freeze for most government programs, education spending would get a healthy bump. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the White House is using the budget to push its agenda for the nation's schools.
The White House wants the education budget to rise about 7% in fiscal year 2011. Most of that money would be directed toward elementary and secondary education. Now, some of the funds would go into traditional programs that address poverty or focus on learning disabled children, but a big chunk, $1.5 billion, will go into a competitive grant program called the Race to the Top Fund. If you've heard of it, it's because that's all the education secretary talks about these days. Race to the Top is already sending over $4 billion to states that agree with the White House on how to fix education. Jack Jennings of the Center on Education Policy says the president's agenda would be a big shift away from awarding grants automatically.
But what he's doing is causing a shift so that some money and some significant amounts of money would be available only if there was change.
We've seen that change already. Many states have relaxed rules on charter schools or changed the way teachers are evaluated in order to get federal funding. The new budget also lays out a roadmap for altering the No Child Left Behind law. The White House wants to do away with some of the punishments that struggling schools have faced. The new law, if Congress goes along, would reward success and encourage states to raise achievement standards. Here again, the administration is using money as a carrot. The White House says it would seek up to $1 billion in additional funding if Congress comes up with a bill that the White House likes. But the administration's new proposals could just complicate the effort to reauthorize this controversial education law. Congress has tried at this and failed before. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and we begin this hour with the latest news from Toyota. Today, the world's largest automaker says it has a solution for the problem of sudden acceleration in some of its vehicles. The company has been forced to recall millions of cars and trucks in recent months. In a moment, we're going to hear from the head of Toyota in the U.S. But first, NPR's Chris Arnold went to a dealership that's gearing up for the massive recall.
At Expressway Toyota in Boston, the mechanics are about to start working around the clock fixing gas pedals.
We think we're going to have an 8 to midnight shift.
Robert Bach owns this dealership with his brother. They have a nice new showroom and a big repair shop. They figure they have about 10,000 customers with cars that will need to have the gas pedals upgraded. Also, 60% of the new cars on the lot here, they can't sell. That's because last week, Toyota ordered dealers to stop selling any cars that need the upgrade. Robert's brother Richard says he was stunned by how many cars are involved.
Almost devastated. You know, we just built a brand new facility. We put our blood, sweat, and tears in it, and we're worried about what's going to come of this. We don't pay cash for our cars. We have to finance them, and we have mortgages on our buildings, so in order to pay that off, we have to sell the vehicles.
So the brothers were very relieved when this morning Toyota announced that it has a fix for the problem. Robert Bach.
I'm excited about the details that we got today because it seems to be an effective and simple fix to this problem. So that is good news, and now we're going to be able to move forward and fix the cars.
Bach says in many cars, the fix will involve installing a small metal plate or shim into the pedal assembly. He says a technician should be able to do that in just half an hour, and he expects a simple part like that will be quick to manufacture, which he says is good. Anxious customers have already been bringing their cars in to get checked out.
I bought a Camry in 2009, and I love it. But I was very concerned about the news about the accelerator, the pedal.
Maria Bartolotto has just come by the dealership. Her Camry is on the recall list.
At first I wasn't concerned, but then I keep hearing all these people that are having accidents, and it's kind of scary. It really is. But yeah, I'm very religious, so I say my prayers. And I have a St. Christopher medal, so hopefully that'll help.
And the dealership's also offering her some more practical advice to restore her faith in Toyota. They are telling customers to put their driver's side floor mat in the trunk so the pedal doesn't get caught on it. The dealership will be shaving down the size of pedals on some models. And they're telling customers what to do in the unlikely event the pedal actually does stick.
And they say the worst thing you can do is to panic. You know, that you should just put your brake on and then put it in neutral.
Bartolotto says she still likes her Camry. And Toyota, of course, had a good reputation for quality for a long time. Some analysts say this incident might show that Toyota has grown too quickly and taken its eye off the ball as far as quality. But dealership owner Robert Bach says so far, most customers have been supportive.
You ask 10 people who own a Toyota, even with this recall, 9 of them will say, fix the car and I want it back. I love my Toyota.
But not everybody.
My mom's one of the moms that worry sick about their children. So as soon as she heard that the recall, she came in here running and screaming, I need a new car.
Marcella Freitas is in the showroom with her mother, Essie, who didn't wait around for the recall. She came right in and traded in her 2009 Corolla for a different model that wasn't part of the recall. She just wasn't sure the recall would actually fix the problem.
And I don't feel safe driving that car.
It's probably a good sign for Toyota, though, that even somebody like Freitas still likes the company, and she bought another Toyota after trading in the Corolla.
They're very loyal. Toyota's worked very hard to develop that loyalty and maintain that loyalty. They're going to set the standard on a recall now.
Or at least Robert Bach hopes they will. His dealership sold 12 cars over the weekend. He says that was about half his normal business. And it's hard to know just how long the recall is going to be hurting his sales.
You never know. If we do it right, it will be an opportunity for us to show that we certainly will take care of our customers and build more brand loyalty. But we got to do it right.
Bach says his dealership should have the parts in stock and be ready to start upgrading gas pedals by this Thursday. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
Isabel Sawhill senior fellow of the economics program at the Brookings Institution, recently invoked the memory of the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan when she wrote about the federal deficit. Moynihan spoke of defining deviancy down, our willingness to accept ever lower norms of social behavior. Sawhill wrote about defining deficits down. Isabel Sawhill, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And I suppose your point is that as the years have gone by, our tolerance for federal budget deficits and for programs that don't reduce them has grown.
That's exactly my point. And, of course, it's very difficult when you have a deficit that is currently around $1.6 trillion and, more importantly, projected to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 or $9 trillion over the next decade. It's hard to have ambitious goals, but I think we shouldn't give up on the idea, which is a very old idea, that we should try to balance our budget, just as a family tries to bring their income and their outgo in line with each other, so should the federal government.
Is it fair to observe here that when people talk about having to raise taxes somewhat to close the deficit gap, Republicans won't hear of it. And when you talk about, say, cutting entitlement spending in order to close the gap, Democrats won't hear of it. Is that relatively accurate description of the logjam we're in?
That is absolutely accurate. Republicans don't want taxes on the table, and Democrats are reluctant to see entitlements cut unless Republicans will meet them halfway on taxes.
When you run the numbers, can you, by saying in the future people will expect a little bit less in their Social Security checks, a little bit less of a benefit from Medicare, and perhaps tax rates will go up by a little bit for people with high incomes, by doing that sort of adjustment, do you actually come out with a balanced budget anytime soon?
It would take a while. You couldn't do it overnight, and you shouldn't try to do it overnight. After all, we are in a recession, and we may stay there for a while. And so I'm not advocating that we cut the existing deficit this year. I am advocating that we legislate right now some measures that will slow the growth of spending over time and raise revenues over time. And if we do it now, it can be less painful and more feasible than if we continue to kick the can down the road, so to speak.
You've been watching this process for some time. Nowadays, it's very common for people to tell you, I'm really concerned about the economy we're leaving to our children. And how do you understand the loss of traction for addressing the budget deficit over the years? Is it just a feature of the recession right now? Is it the boredom of the Washington press corps and paying enough attention to it? How do you understand the defining the deficits down that you've observed?
Well, I think it does go to some of the problems in political life right now. I, along with a group of others, have spent a lot of time over the last few years going around the country giving talks to ordinary citizens about the fiscal future we face. And we find that the public is very concerned about the issue and that they get it. They want something done. The problem has been that most of the people who must take action need to get themselves reelected or want to get themselves reelected. And it's very hard to get reelected if you have cut spending or raised taxes. So the problem basically is a lack of political will.
I've seen the same audiences when they're told about what the deficits look like, how they've been growing, and what ought to be done. There's enthusiasm for addressing these problems. I mean, there seems to be some disconnect between at least what people say they want Washington to do and the message that politicians, you say they lack the will, but it seems to be what they've measured in the way of real public sentiment as to what people really want to see done.
Well, of course, the public hasn't been well educated on these issues. And, of course, we've gotten away with running large deficits for a number of years now, and nothing terrible has happened. So people say to themselves, well, we might as well just keep borrowing. So I don't want to imply it's easy to get the public to focus on this. But let's go back to 1992 when Ross Perot was running for president. And he focused on this issue like a laser beam, and he got 19% of the vote. And when Clinton was elected, because of the Perot showing in the election, Clinton felt he needed to focus on the deficit. So by the year 2000, we were actually running surpluses in the federal budget.
Of course, the way that Democrats would also recall that is that along the way, they were ousted from virtually every majority they enjoyed in 1994. And so I'm not entirely clear that the political payoff was appreciated by Democrats when Bill Clinton became a deficit hawk.
I think that's a good point. There may be a political price to pay. We have our current president saying that he'd rather be a good one-term president than a okay two-term president. And maybe someone needs to fall on their sword on this issue for the benefit of the longer-term strength of this country.
Dr. Sawhill, thank you very much for talking with us once again.
Thank you for having me.
That's Isabel Sawhill, senior fellow in the economics program at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C.
When the Oscar nominations come out this morning, 10 movies will be up for Best Picture. That's double the traditional five. Steve Inskeep got the scoop from reporter Kim Masters, who's following all things Oscar from Los Angeles.
Okay, 10 Best Picture nominations?
Yes, 10. And the irony is there could have been maybe two or three. You know, they were trying to expand the Oscars to get the popular movies in. And surprise, surprise, the popular movies would have been in regardless. Now, you are going to see certain movies in the mix, maybe up in the air. I mean, definitely up in the air, mm-hmm. Inglourious Basterds. But there are really two movies, I think, that are in contention here. Steve, can you guess which two are in contention?
No, I have no idea. I have no clue. But you one of them might start with an A.
Yes. So one of them does start with an A. That would be Avatar, the biggest picture of all time, likely to pass $2 billion in gross. And that is up against, it seems at this point, a little movie, perhaps the lowest grossing movie ever to be in contention, The Hurt Locker.
Well, let's give a listen to these two movies so we get a sense of the difference between the two of these major contenders.
We have an indigenous population of humanoids called the Na'vi. They're fond of arrows dipped in a neurotoxin that'll stop your heart in 1 minute. They are very hard to kill.
25 meters, roger that.
Butcher shop, 2 o'clock, dude has a phone.
Why is Eldridge running? Come on, guys, talk to me.
Drop the phone!
Hey, Brody!
I can't get a shot!
You go from a fantasy about killing in war to a brutally real depiction of killing in war.
To the real battle at the Academy, the Battle of the X's, because the two directors of this film, James Cameron for Avatar and Catherine Bigelow for Hurt Locker, used to be married. And so this is the Battle of the X's. Now, I had a chance to ask Catherine Bigelow about Cameron some years back. She would not talk about him at all. But they've gone to great lengths to make it clear that they are friends, and he's made it clear he is rooting for her. Also, that would be the first time a woman director, should she win Best Director, has won. I can't believe we're saying that in 2010, but that's the way it is.
And I find something striking about a woman director of an acclaimed war film.
Yes, she is unusual for that. Her films are, you know, known to be, to use a probably bad word, masculine, you know, kind of dark, tough, gritty, big action. You know, she's certainly an atypical female director, but she is a female director.
Okay, so 10 films will be nominated for Best Picture Oscar this morning. We've named two that seem likely to be in there. 8 others will be in. What about the Best Actor and Actress categories?
We seem to have a little bit of a race in Best Actress, which would be Sandra Bullock versus Meryl Streep. Sandra Bullock for The Blind Side, Meryl Streep for Julie and Julia. Sandra Bullock won the Golden Globe. Meryl Streep, of course, is Meryl Streep, so we'll see how that turns out. You know, some people thought The Blind Side could have been on Lifetime, but she's quite popular, Sandra Bullock. And Best Actor, you know, there's a kind of a front runner there. I'm going to quiz you again, Steve. Who is it?
I don't know. George Clooney. I don't know.
You don't know. You're so not in L.A.
Well, it's true.
Jeff Bridges seems to have a commanding lead for playing an aging country singer in Crazy Heart. Mm. He is so good in that movie that it seems to be sort of a film draped around a performance. And he is a formidable contender. It's hard to know who could take it from him.
Kim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Kim Masters hosts The Business on member station KCRW.
And that, of course, Steve Inskeep talking to Kim.